Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that lie in the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont.
In an investing world where the new thing can too easily grab investor attention, sometimes it's the case that an institution, especially one almost 200 years old, may be taken for granted, overlooked, or simply considered less relevant. But what if you've never been as relevant or as profitable? What if you're financing tracts of key infrastructure, from housing to universities, helping regenerate communities, and are a vital cog in the UK savings and pension markets, managing 1.4 trillion with 10,000 employees whilst achieving a 20% return on equity? So today, to examine this organisation, I have one of the longest-serving FTSE 100 CEOs, a man knighted for his contributions to finance and regional development, and charged with running the second-largest institutional asset manager in Europe. And if that's not enough to keep him occupied, he's also a winner of several Masters athletic competitions and a key Newcastle football supporter. Sir Nigel Wilson, Chief Executive of Legal & General PLC, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
That was probably the best marketing I've ever heard about the company, so congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. As I researched you and Legal & General, I became increasingly intrigued with what your firm is today and how it's changed. But let's start with you. A degree from the University of Essex in economics and then a PhD from MIT in the US. A degree to a PhD is a big leap. Why did that come about?
I was originally planning to be an academic, and I loved academic life. I loved teaching. I loved doing research. Particularly teaching, as it turned out. And I ended up at MIT through various scholarships and had a wonderful time there. I learned a huge amount. But there was one day when I was teaching with a chap called Bob Shiller, and I realized very quickly one of us was going to get the Nobel Prize for economics and one of us wasn't. So I better look for something else to do and went on to work for McKinsey. And that was the start of a very interesting and rewarding business career.
So you started as a management consultant. How long did you stay there?
The plan was always to learn as much as quickly as possible working for McKinsey. When I left, I was running three studies at the same time across many different sectors, which you were allowed to do in those days. So it was a hugely interesting learning experience. But I wanted to learn more commercially about what was running business really like. And that's why I left McKinsey and moved on to a different career.
I think that's why you know our mutual friend Alan Morgan as well, isn't it?
Indeed. We co-invested on a very successful investment. Alan has reinvented himself as well and is doing a great job.
He's a trustee with me on a school's charity, so that's how I know him. How did you then get the either inspiration, nod or call to move across to financial services?
I consulted to financial services when I was at McKinsey, including working for Globe, a business from the past, Citibank, Banco Santander, when they were a small regional Spanish bank, and a number of other clients. So I was always interested in financial services. when Legal & General offered me the job of CFO with the prospect of becoming CEO, I thought it was a wonderful opportunity because it's a great brand name and financial services was changing and I wanted to be in an industry that was changing. It was a huge opportunity. And in February of 2009, I agreed to join and the share price hit an all-time low of 20p, I think, at that particular time. And lots of people were telling me, why could I possibly be doing this? But it's been a wonderful journey so far and there's still a huge amount to achieve.
So you've been CEO since June 2012, and your recently posted 2021 results showed £2 billion of post-tax earnings. And in your presentation, you said it's 177 years to reach £1 billion of profitability, but only 7 years to get from there to £2 billion. And as I see it, this is a journey of a company from a life and pensions group with an asset management arm to something very different and wider. As I thought about what I wanted to ask you, one of my first questions is, if you weren't classified as an insurance company, to someone who doesn't know the business, how would you best describe it today?
We're an asset originator and an asset manager. We try and match assets with liabilities. And the world is producing a huge amount of new liabilities in pension, in climate change, in insurance. And we're helping to self-manufacture assets for a huge amount of different activities, all of which are very profitable and very scalable, not just in the UK, but globally. That's a great win-win for us.
As I see it, you have four key pillars of your business. Give a sentence on each and then we can drill down into two of the particular businesses.
Our pension risk transfer business is the global leader. I have never met a CFO who tells me he wants more pension risk. Every one of them telling me, how can you get rid of the pension risk and actually over time do that? And that's going to become an even bigger business going forward and even more global business going forward. Institutional asset manager, you've already headlined for us, is 1.4 trillion of assets under management. About 400 billion of that is outside of the UK. We're market leaders in DB pensions and DC pensions. And this long-term macro and demographic trends are ones that we play into in institutional asset management. Our capital business, Legal & General Capital, invests directly in lots of different asset classes. You mentioned housing, but we have energy, we have universities in particular, but lots of the activities that go around universities. Urban regeneration, we're in 15 different cities across the UK, doing lots of things which add to the economically and socially useful role that we have in society. And our retail business has pulled together all of our retail customers. We have approximately 10 to 11 billion here in the UK, but a growing number in the United States and indeed in Asia and Europe. We've pooled all of our retail businesses into one area.
Very big in the passive space, but you have active as well under your umbrella.
Passive space is 200 billion of that 1.4 trillion.
How do you see this balance between active and passive evolving in the next decade?
Yeah. It's interesting that we've evolved it already. We see great opportunities for further growth in the business. We think of active as being a slightly different thing. Our liability-driven investment business, which is 560 billion, we're bigger than our index business or passive business, is actively trying to manage the balance sheet liabilities of our corporates. And that's what it does. It's liability-driven investment. So it's solving a different problem, matching long-term assets to long-term liabilities. And the liabilities are very well known. Fixed income, real assets, ETFs are all part of what we do already, and it will be an increasing part of our business going forward.
Your Legal & General Capital business looks to me, and we've interviewed Blackstone and many others, like an alternatives business. Tell me a little bit about how that developed and where you see it in the overall equation.
With an ex post rationalization of the strategy, it all looks incredibly logic right now. But at the time, there was this growing demand for private investments. Just take housing as an example. There's a huge housing shortage, not just here in the UK, but in many other markets as well. We identified the housing market with build to sell, build to rent, affordable housing as a really important asset class, which required a huge amount of new investment and had been underinvested by institutional investors for a very long period of time. We've just stepped up and played a much bigger role in that market, and we have very good businesses in each line of that. If I think of energy, when I started out in business, we had clean and green, but very expensive energy. We've now got clean, green, and cheap. And so we've made a lot of strategic investments in the energy space. Pod Points, our EV charging business, Onto is our EV car leasing business. We have a large onshore and offshore wind business. We have a solar business. We do perovskite, which is a way of making solar panels more efficient. We've got battery storage business. We own 35% of the UK's largest ground source heating business. We're in air source heating. A bit of nuclear fusion as well from some brilliant academics in Oxford. So we've seen these very big macro trends happening and have leaned into those things and investing in real assets, creating real jobs in the real economy. We think that's the right thing to do rather than bid up the price of old assets. And that's central to our investment philosophy.
I just want to come back to the housing. You're right, there's 1.2 million people in the UK on waiting lists for houses. That seemed like an enormous number. But you were investing in Sheffield, Leeds, Manchester, Oxford. Tell me a little bit about your geographical priorities and how this plays out when we're all frustrated at the lack of release of land for housing to assuage the problem.
It's been a problem since 1979, 1980, when the Housing Acts came in and effectively all the council houses were sold off. And there was very much a focus on build to sell, but a little bit of buy to let. We've tried to transform that industry into working on projects that make a difference, where we will take on a very large site, but it'll have build-to-sell, affordable housing, build-to-rent housing, modular construction, schools, shops, sporting facilities. We're uniquely placed to do that here in the UK, and we have different institutional investors who want different parts of that business model. We can pool all that together and create a very attractive investable proposition and convince people that this is the right place to build at scale to make a real difference, because NIMBYism is still greater than we'd like it to be here in the UK.
Can I just push you on that? You say uniquely placed. There's a lot of financial firepower around the system. What makes you so different?
Well, nobody else does that. If I was to say, tell me another house builder who actually puts together affordable, build-to-rent, urban, suburban, modular construction, later life living, as well as build-to-sell, and is happy to build all the infrastructure around that. We wanted people to do that, but we failed on that. We found that actually now people are getting in. Institutionally owned build to rent is now become a very acceptable asset class here in the UK. We started on that journey 10 years ago, ironically outside of London. So we did it in Manchester and we're doing it in Cardiff and Oxford and all of these other places that you mentioned earlier on.
Tell me a little bit, because the Oxford number seems like a large number. It looks like it's a £4 billion partnership with the University of Oxford. And we had Jack Edmondson, who's the deputy CIO at Oxford University Endowment, on the show last year in a really interesting interview. But give us a little color on how that came about and what you think you end up with.
We've started on this journey many years ago on about what was the role of a university in a city. How should the university interact with a city and indeed interact with its own IP? So we very much want universities in Britain to monetize themselves much more effectively, commercialize themselves a lot more effectively than they have in the past. As you mentioned earlier, I went to MIT. MIT's done a brilliant job, as at Harvard and Stanford and many other areas. We have about 15 different partnerships with different universities across the UK. Oxford desperately needs modernizing. It's a wonderful place to visit, and it's got some incredible scientists working in non-modern facilities, but it has no graduate accommodation, not enough. It doesn't have key worker accommodation, postgraduates, visiting professors, and the whole infrastructure around Oxford needs massive upgrading. So we had a very constructive dialogue with the university and said, you should just partner with us. And they had a bit of a competition, which we won. But we've done the same in Manchester, £2 billion project there. Quite a lot of others, fantastic partnerships across the UK to really try and make a difference. It's a win-win. It's commercially successful for us, and it's investing in the new, in real economy, creating real jobs and solving real societal problems.
I want to switch tack and look at your pension risk transfer business. You said that there isn't a CEO or CFO out there that isn't scratching his head about his pension. Yeah. And we had last year Tracy Blackwell from the Pension Insurance Corporation on. Why is it such a compelling business?
It's a $5 trillion market. We've only done a few hundred billion at the moment, so it's enormous. From a societal point of view, it makes a huge amount of sense if we can pool all the assets together and take on projects like Oxford. I don't know anybody who thinks that's a mad thing to do. Ironically, we're using things like the Rolls-Royce Pension Fund, which is one of our PRT clients, to invest in Oxford University, as it were, the students of today who'll actually fulfill the Rolls-Royce jobs of tomorrow. It's a very, very synergistic model from that point of view. The individual pension funds couldn't do £4 billion on their own, but being pooled across things. And that's what we do as a business. We pool lots of things together. LDI is about pooling assets and creating real scale in these businesses. And we're uniquely placed to do that because we have an enormous balance sheet and people trust us and we will take on these projects.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come. But a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine. And as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. As you are thinking about both the creation of the assets and where you're investing, unlike 20 years ago, there is this requirement to think socially. You have termed it inclusive capitalism. Looking through the notes, I see all the way back to the 1970s, you had a CEO, Ron Peet, who was vociferous in campaigning for the My Children. So it seems like it's a little bit in the DNA of L&G, but doing good and remembering you're working for shareholders, how do you weigh up those sometimes what would appear to be competing forces?
It's almost sad that people do think of them as competing forces. People want them to be coexisting together. This idea that you just bid up the assets of the past or invest in hot things for a very short period of time is the way to make money. We do make money the hard way. It's over a very long period of time. But as you mentioned in your opening comments, we have a 20% ROE. Very few financial service organizations of our scale anywhere in the world get that. And we believe in it. As you look in the corner of my office there, you see my bike. I cycle to work, run or walk to work. I'm a great believer in public transport and public infrastructure and the need to upgrade that, that actually our education system needs modernizing and upgrading it. And Oxford is a deprived county. In every big city, we have deprived areas and they need build to rent. They need social housing. They need better jobs. They need investment in the new. That's what we're about as a firm. The fact that it's economically and socially useful is a good thing, not a bad thing for shareholders, because it helps build our brand, the trust in our brand. Financial services companies need more trust, and we always come either first and second on any trust measure there is. We're very proud of that, and people get attracted to work for us because we're doing the right things for the right reasons and delivering the right outcomes. Similarly, people want to engage with us because they trust us to be custodian of assets for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Oxford wanted a 40 to 50 year partnership. Originally, they wanted a 100-year partnership. We don't think we have any 100-year liabilities.
With a big indexing business for the world that has moved increasingly to passive, is how do you think firms like yours and others should approach this idea of engagement? Because it's easy to pass over money to a passive investor or group who may not vote or be active or agitate. And it's obviously easy as well for people to disinvest from businesses that they think don't meet criteria as opposed to engage.
We want to be engaged. We manage 200 billion of assets. In that sense, it's a huge business and a very important business. But actually, economically, it's not as important as it once was historically. We're very proud of the fact that we actively engage on issues that really matter for shareholders, and we want companies to build trust in themselves, and therefore they're prepared to get involved in issues around women on boards, compensation, on climate change. These are things that people who invest in are really interested in.
There are a number, and possibly a growing number, of macro fragilities in the UK, but globally, that we know of: inflation, negative real rates, slowing growth, potentially even a recession within 12 months. What does that mean for your businesses, or is actually some beneficiaries while some might be hurt?
At a macro level, interest rates rising is good for our industry. I'm confident we'll continue to do very well out of it. The fact that we have a 20, 30, 40 year view of things and we're matching assets and liabilities over 20, 30, 40 years means that we'll be very resilient around this. And we've been around for, as you mentioned earlier, over 180 years. So there's something inherently resilient about our business. What role will we play in helping to lean into these trends is one that we're very interested in. The UK has suffered from underinvestment for 30 or 40 years, and we have to change that. And to do that, we have to invest more. Our particular model is a very resilient one to get, because if we're matching assets and liabilities, we're not being forced into selling assets off when there are short-term fluctuations because they're very well matched on our balance sheet.
Financial services is an evolving and dynamic business. What do you think the biggest challenges to the broad financial services industry will be over the next decade?
It has been for quite a long time. Regulation plays the biggest role in this. There's huge customer need and there's huge investment need. And our regulators have to work in partnership with ourselves and the government to figure out what's the right role for us to play in stimulating economic growth whilst making sure that we protect policyholders' interests, because it's in everybody's interest. Policyholders are well looked after. Shareholders are well looked after.
We've talked a lot about the UK because of your significant footprint here, but I read that L&G's brand and culture travel well. Tell us a little bit about what's happening and how you're figuring the Asian markets and others where you already are, where the growth may be very strong and secular.
It's been very pleasant that actually our brand does travel so well. Japan, China, United States, across Europe. As I mentioned earlier, our fund management business is about $400 billion outside of the UK. But people like inclusive capitalism as a theme, that actually it's highly relevant in all countries that we visited so far. I do this presentation, which I do to lots of academic institutions as well as to clients. People want to be part of something that is economically, socially useful and has high moral principles. The decline of morality over a long period of time has been something that we have seen. Lots of evidence of that. But projects like health inequality, our partnership with Sir Michael Marmot here, is something that people are really interested in. COVID's really brought home how fragile we all are and how important it is to have great health yourself personally, but actually have a great health system and a robust and resilient health system behind. Also, what science can really do under this incredible stress and pressure that they had to work and deliver. The fact that we've been on this journey for many years, you talked about Ron Peete, but this is a long journey of not just myself as chief executive, but my predecessors as well, about trying to do the right thing in the health space. Even though, to a certain extent, it's not in our interest if people live longer and longer lives, but actually that's not what we're seeing at all. Life expectancy is going backwards in large parts of the world, and healthy life expectancy is shocking in parts of the world. And we want to be investing to prevent that. We want people to enjoy a good life, and too many people are not enjoying a good life because we've got too much inequality and not enough economically and socially useful investment happening.
I'd like to pause on board composition. We had Peter Harrison, as I mentioned earlier, one of our guests, CEO of Schroders, and he talked of one thing he wanted to achieve on his board is neurodiversity. A lot of people are struggling with board composition. What are your one or two priorities as you think about your board?
I think we've got the right composition. We've achieved all of the respective targets. We've got a very engaged board who are very proud of what we've achieved. We took everyone to Oxford to see what we're doing there. A couple of weeks ago, everyone went to Manchester. We've been to Bristol, Cardiff. We're in the States later this year looking at the things that we're doing there. Our board likes what we're doing, and they're being very constructive in helping to think about what are the next things we should be doing.
But I was struck by a Harvard Business School study that actually showed across the US how little representation on boards in the US there is from the world of technology. And I wondered how you, somebody who studied at MIT, thinks about that requirement.
We have ample on these areas. Your macro point is correct. Too many boards have got too many friends and family to a certain extent on them. You want constructive challenge, but you want a constructive contribution at the same time. And I think our regulators have to realize there's a difference between challenging for the sake of challenging and actually constructive should be the word that's put in, both for challenge, but actually for opportunities as well, because the world is amazing for opportunities. Technology, as you were highlighting, is the most exciting it's ever been since the 1850s, 1860s. We have to lean into that. We have amazing academic institutions in both the UK and the United States. They've got to punch their weight and they can do a lot more and make a much bigger economic impact. And that we've been leaning into for a number of years.
Going back to the results that you just produced, which were very strong, in your results presentation, you said in terms of looking at comparators, it's a small peer group. And I wondered about how you think the market views you and how that's reflected in your valuation.
We're still seen as an insurance company with an index business. and that contributes about 15% of our total profit. So it's not that that's a really important part of our profit. And this transformation that we've been undergoing and this mission around inclusive capitalism has resulted in a very profitable and scalable model. We're still on that journey and we're bringing investors along with us. It is a journey and we're still making huge progress in those areas and people are just watching and observing what we're doing. We don't fit in a particular category well at the moment on this journey that we're on. We're a very big asset manager and asset originator with insurance, but also these physical activities as well. Fantastically successful venture capital business to add on to the group. Onshore wind and offshore wind and solar and all of these areas are very successful in their own rights too.
And one of the things that makes you very different is the yield on the stock is around 7%. Putting tax aside, at 7% yield, your money doubles every 10 years. How do you think about the importance of the dividend for your shareholders?
When we, during the pandemic, said that we were absolutely going to pay our dividend, in contrast to many, many other financial services companies, I've never been so popular with our shareholders. And the number of people who rang me or called me up or whatever, or sent nice messages to us, was fantastic. And it really brought it home how important this is. It's people's income. A lot of people are retired and they rely on this income. And it either feeds in directly from their own personal holdings or through their specific pension funds.
Is there a frustration? I know at the time of the GFC, the government was trying to get financial institutions to cut their dividends. I mean, should the governments and this government just back off and the government's trying to micromanage organizations that they don't really understand?
There's multiple different parts to that question. The government has a pretty good understanding of our business. We certainly interact with them a lot. We're very involved in the Levelling Up. I'm one of the two business people on the Levelling Up committee. There's a very strong recognition of what we're doing is the right things, whether that's in social care, in life sciences, in many other areas where we're very well represented. That's not going to go away at all. How we handle dividend decisions is a complicated one, and particularly when the government owns a very large part of one of the biggest banks in the UK, and for a long time owned several parts of other banks in the UK, and certainly feels, having bailed out some of those during the crisis, that it has a say in what happens. As it turns out, I think they've been pretty supportive of us.
I think the average tenure for a UK CEO is 5.25 years. You have outlasted that extraordinarily. Why do you think you've thrived for so long?
I think I've got great colleagues. That's what makes the difference. We have a great culture around that. We're solving problems that excite me. It's something that I've, since I was a young person, been challenged by. You know, how do you really make a difference? We as an organization, myself, within that organization, are making a real societal difference. And hence the very proud and privileged moment when I was told I was being knighted. It's not very often you get knighted when you're still in role. It's even less often when you're working in financial services. So I think that's true recognition of the role that we have played for a number of years. And I feel very proud about that.
You can't see my question sheet here, but the next one was knighted in 2022. What was your reaction on hearing it?
Initially very surprised, wondering whether it was some of my cruel friends playing a joke. However, very proud when it happened. And there's a sudden feeling over you where you said, wow, this is amazing for somebody who grew up on a council estate in the north of England and thought the pinnacle was going to be scholarships to MIT. But my life's gone on and on and on as a consequence of that. Part of that is intellectual honesty. Tell me what you think, not what you think I want to hear. And part of it is philosophic. Part of my role is to search for the truth for the common good. We can do the common good through the sorts of investments that we're doing as a firm and deliver for everyone, which may not always be in vogue, but for the long-term value and the brand and for our people, it's really important that we have that very long-term view that allows us to keep on investing. We did one of our biggest PRT deals a week after Brexit happened. People were saying, will this be the end of the market? We said, well, have you just done one? That's not the case whatsoever.
You've won several National Masters Athletics Championships. And I see you in your office here where we're sitting with some great sports memorabilia. What do you compete in and how do you train?
In a different life, I thought I was going to be a professional footballer. Sadly failed. Not quite good enough. I'm decelerating slower than other people, not accelerating. So I found how to decelerate slower, not get faster. And that's been one of the keys to the success. But I was pretty good at 100 to half marathon, not absolutely good enough at any of them. So I have a huge range of things. And I enjoy training. As I mentioned, I can jog into the office. For many years, competed for Windsor Slough and Eton and Hounslow Athletics. I was always the last person they'd pick on a Friday night to turn out. I was pretty much happy to do anything for the team. And it was just what I enjoy doing. And obviously, my 5 beautiful daughters were all very keen athletes as well. I've always been able to compartmentalize my life. I can switch off completely from work, do these other activities, which I really enjoy, without thinking, oh gosh, I've got to deal with these horrible problems tomorrow when I come to the office, or let me go away and think about this a little bit more. I just move on and do something else. And athletics and health in general has been a really important part of my life.
So you mentioned you've got five daughters. A good pal of mine has four daughters, and he said four weddings and my funeral. I have only two, as does Will Campion, daughters. But what advice would you give as a father of daughters?
It's been wonderful. I've done four of the weddings, and so they've only got one to go. So unless there's something about my health I don't know, it'll be the fifth before the funeral. And I enjoyed having a busy life. It wasn't quite like the Bennetts of Pride and Prejudice. It was a lot more enjoyable than that, and Mr. Bennet was not a role model. I'm, again, very proud to be a father of five beautiful and talented and strong-willed and various things that I won't say just in case they're here.
Well, I hope they will be listening. My 93-year-old father, Jean Breul, who listens to my podcast religiously because he probably has to, has owned your shares, he says, for decades, and was very pleased to know that I was doing this interview and I might well be following in that tradition. But two specific takeaways. One is that I think it'd be fair to say this is not the legal and general of yesteryear. It's been very interesting to hear how you have reshaped and helped with your colleagues change this business for today's climate. Two particular pieces of advice I'm going to take on board. As far as boards are concerned, they need to be constituted both to challenge but also to offer up opportunities. And I like that your colleagues need to tell me what you think, not what you think I want to hear. And that is often a dilemma for people when they get to the top and they're surrounded.
As you can see, I don't have a desk in my office. Everything is about communications and feeling open to communicate. This is a octagonal table, which again is to reflect the fact that we want meritocratic solutions and not autocratic solutions. That's really been a key to our success.
Rick Saunders, who's the former head of Deutsche Bank Equity, said if Nigel had been the prime minister, we would have had a lot more that this country needs achieved in a much shorter space of time. And I finally want to thank Patrick Wellington, who is the vice chairman of equity advisory at Rothschilds, for making the introduction so you and I can have the conversation today. So thank you.
Two very talented individuals and obviously both got good judgment.
Well, good luck and thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.